but when he arrived at the Hillsdale campus, he could hardly get to the witnesses. Journalists looking for answers had swarmed the campus and the farm, and emotions ran so high that even the police now saw flying saucers everywhere. The head of Blue Book called Heineck in Michigan and told him to stand up before a crowd of reporters in this near-hysterical community and issue a statement on the cause of the sightings. But Heineck had nothing to say. He had no idea what could have caused the lights. Searching for a justifiable explanation of the sightings, he wrote in the 1966 Saturday Evening Post article, "I remembered a phone call from a botanist at the University of Michigan, who called to my attention the phenomenon of burning swamp gas. 3 days after he began his investigation, in the midst of being pulled in one direction by TV cameramen and in another by news reporters at the largest press conference in the history of the Detroit Press Club, Heineck uttered the word swamp gas. He had only meant to say that this rare gas, known to burst into tiny flames that sometimes floated above the ground, was a possible cause of the sightings, but no sooner had the word slipped out of his mouth than the press conference erupted in a clamor of reporters rushing to the phone. The Air Force and Heineck both looked foolish. Not one of the 100-plus people who had witnessed the lights accepted the explanation. The civil defense director said that the pulsating lights he had watched through binoculars for 3 hours that night unquestionably came from some kind of vehicle. House Minority Leader Gerald R. Ford castigated the Air Force for their flippant answer to the Michigan sightings and called for a full-blown congressional investigation into UFOs. 2.5 weeks later, for the first time in the 19-year history of the phenomenon, the House Armed Services Committee held open hearings on UFOs. At that point, said Heineck in an Omni magazine interview in 1985, I had to ask myself when I would become scientifically honest and say that I just didn't know what the sightings were and that they deserved further investigation. During the congressional hearings of April 5, 1966, Secretary of the Air Force Harold D. Brown revealed that an ad hoc group of scientists called the O'Brien Panel had secretly convened only 6 months earlier to review the UFO problem. The panel had concluded that UFO sightings had potential scientific value and recommended that the Air Force supplement Blue Book with science teams from selected universities who could mobilize quickly, gather data while fresh, and evaluate the data thoroughly. But with few sightings being reported and public interest on the wane, the Air Force had felt no pressure to implement the panel's recommendations, so it had done nothing. Now, with press coverage of the recent Michigan sightings firing public interest and Congress pressuring the Air Force to find answers, Secretary Brown told the House Armed Services Committee that the Air Force would immediately begin a search outside the military for teams of scientists to study the UFO problem. The subject embodied so much misunderstanding and sensation, however, that several universities, including Harvard, MIT, University of North Carolina, and University of California, refused to participate. After months of searching, the Air Force Office of Scientific Research finally offered a $313,000 grant to Dr. Edward Alakundan at the University of Colorado to conduct the entire study with the help of special consultants and a staff of 12, half of whom were scientists or psychologists. What became known as the Kundan Committee remains the most controversial episode in 40 years of UFO history. Kundan, 64. A noted physicist and former president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, had once served as deputy director of the highly secret Manhattan Project at Los Alamos, where he provided several pieces to the A-bomb puzzle. He also had been instrumental in the development of radar. His stature as a scientist satisfied both the Air Force and the science community, and his reputation for bucking governmental authority. He was one of the few to checkmate young Richard Nixon and the House Un-American Activities Committee, seemed to assure that UFOs would receive a fair hearing. But in September 1966, 2 weeks prior to the first meeting of the committee, Heineck had dinner with Kundan. Later, in the Omni interview, Heineck recalled that the renowned scientist was quite clearly negative toward the subject of UFOs. When Heineck then visited the project offices, He found the project coordinator, Bob Lowe, already writing on a blackboard the chapter headings and conclusions for a report that as yet had not been researched and would not be complete for another 2 years. Hynek's early experiences with the two men running the project would prove prophetic. Though the Air Force, at the behest of Congress, had established the Condon Committee to settle the UFO controversy, within months the committee itself was adding to the confusion. In January 1967, Condon addressed an honorary scientific fraternity, telling them, "It is my inclination right now to recommend that the government get out of this business. My attitude right now is that there's nothing to it." Then, according to the Star Gazette in Elmira, New York, he smiled and added, "But I'm not supposed to reach a conclusion for another year." A mesmerizing storyteller, Condon loved to spin a good yarn and kept many audiences in near hysterics with material provided him by the lunatic fringe with which he came in contact during his tenure as head of the committee. For instance, a well-dressed gentleman in his 50s arrived at committee headquarters one day in a chauffeured Cadillac, announced himself as Sir Salvador, agent of the Third Universe. The Second Universe was populated by bears, and demanded $3 billion to build a spaceport to accommodate ships from the Third Universe trying to land on Earth. According to UFOs? Yes, a book published in 1969 by Condon Committee psychologist Dr. David Saunders, Condon actually researched the case and found that Sir Salvador had recently been released from a mental institution. Nevertheless, Condon soberly reported his findings to Washington. When an Ontario, California man gave a specific date and time for an imminent on the Bonneville Salt Flats, Condon notified the governor of Utah and dispatched an investigator who waited for 2 hours in vain next to members of the Utah Highway Patrol and a brass band. In September 1967, the Rocky Mountain News in Denver quoted Condon as saying, "The 21st century may die laughing when it looks back on many things we have done. This, the UFO study, may be one." Condon himself investigated few, if any, of the truly perplexing cases and rarely discussed the progress of serious research with his staff. In fact, his staff saw little of him. And Lowe, who ran the project in Condon's absence, refused to investigate potentially important cases suggested by the staff. At the same time, he occupied himself with what other members considered irrelevant research. On one trip to Europe, ostensibly to research UFOs, Lowe spent much of his time in Scotland studying the mystery of the Loch Ness Monster. According to Saunders's book, Lowe explained later that this was relevant to UFOs because neither one exists and it was important to see how they were studying something that does not exist. Because of his own experiences as a scientist, Hynek anticipated that the committee would find UFOs of importance to the national interest, and that the committee would recommend that Congress establish a commission for studying the many truly scientifically challenging cases. In a letter to Condon in January 1967, he wrote, "There are so many scientists who have now expressed a subterranean interest in UFOs that I am moved to organize, as loosely as possible, an invisible college of interested scientists." But as months passed, Hynek and others who addressed the committee noticed both Condon's and Lowe's disturbing preoccupation with the obviously explainable reports. Condon continued to make jokes in public about contactees, giving the impression that such stories formed the bulk of UFO facts. And Lowe was too quick to point out how easily most cases proved to be some sort of astronomical phenomena or a misidentification of a known object. UFO researchers have known this for years. They wanted an explanation for the difficult cases. Then, in the summer of 1967, one of the scientists on the staff discovered a memorandum written by Lowe in August 1966, just before the university signed the contract with the Air Force. Lowe had titled the memo "Some Thoughts on the UFO Project," and addressed it to university officials. In the memo, he noted that several of the scientists at the university wanted to avoid the project because the study would have to be objective, and that meant admitting the possibility that UFOs exist. Lowe capsulized their feelings by saying, "It is not respectable to give serious consideration to such a possibility." But Lowe had an answer. He wrote, The trick would be, I think, to describe the project so that, to the public, it would appear a totally objective study but, to the scientific community, would present the image of a group of non-believers trying their best to be objective but having an almost zero expectation of finding a saucer. One way to achieve this, he suggested, would be to stress the investigation of the psychological makeup of people who claim to see UFOs and to downplay the physical evidence. Lowe's memo so offended Saunders and Dr. Norman Levine, an electrical engineer on the staff, that they sent it to Donald Kehoe, who tuned it over to a prominent scientist outside the committee. Condon countered by firing Saunders and Levine for incompetence. 2 weeks later, February 15, 1968, Mary Louise Armstrong, Lowe's administrative assistant, resigned, stating in her letter of resignation that there was an almost unanimous lack of confidence in Lowe and that Lowe had indicated little interest in talking to those who carried out the investigations or in reading their reports. She could not understand how most of the scientists had arrived at such radically different conclusions from Lowe's and noted there was a fairly good consensus among the team members that there is enough data in the UFO question to warrant further study. To say in our final report, she continued, as I believe Bob would like to, that although we can't prove that it does not exist, we can say that there isn't much evidence to suggest it does, would not be correct. I do not understand how he can make such a statement when those who have done the work of digging into the sighting information do not think this is true. I do not think it is an unfair conclusion on our part to say that Bob is misrepresenting us. Other staff members quit, too, and an article in Look, May 14, 1968, publicly exposed the problems within the Condon Committee, promoting a new congressional investigation. On July 29, 1968, as the Condon Committee began winding down its operation and writing its final report, Hynek, Dr. Carl Sagan, and four other scientists, including Dr. James McDonald, testified before the House Committee on Space and Astronautics. In only a few years, Jim McDonald had become the most articulate proponent of UFO study. Tall, lean, dynamic, and with a photographic memory, he was far more vocal than Hynek. David Michael Jacobs, in the controversy over unidentified flying objects in America, reported that at the first meeting between McDonald and Hynek in 1967, McDonald had walked into Hynek's office, pounded on his desk, and exclaimed, "How could you sit on this information for so many years without alerting the scientific community?" Holder of a master's degree from MIT and a doctor of philosophy from Iowa State University, McDonald headed the Institute of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Arizona. Highly respected, he had done extensive research on cloud seeding, hurricane reduction, and ozone problems caused by SST emissions. Though he had discovered UFOs much later than Hynek, he called the study of UFOs the most important scientific problem of our time, adding that we do not know what they are because we have laughed them out of court. "My own present opinion, based on 2 years of careful study," he told the House Committee on Space and Aeronautics, "is that UFOs are probably extraterrestrial devices engaged in something that might be very tentatively termed surveillance." Indeed, he added, "I have to state, for the record, that I believe no other problem within your jurisdiction is of comparable scientific and national importance." These are strong words, and I intend them to be. Hynek told the committee that only two things kept scientists away from UFOs. One was lack of hard data. The Air Force, interested only in national security, had failed to collect sufficient scientific data. The other was the sensationalizing of UFOs by contactees and pulp magazines. "Between the two," said Hynek, "the science community's misconception of UFO information was powerful and all-encompassing." Each of the experts to testify before the committee recommended the subject be given further scientific study. Then, the committee adjourned and everyone awaited the Condon Committee's final report. On November 15, 1968, the Condon Committee released a document 1,485 pages long. The committee had examined 91 cases, each listed in one of five categories, astronaut sightings, optical and radar sightings, old cases, new cases, and photographic evidence. Astronomer and professor of astrogeophysics, Dr. Franklin Roach, wrote the chapter entitled Visual Observations Made by U.S. Astronauts. A consultant to NASA, Roach had briefed and debriefed the astronauts on their experiences in space aboard Mercury and Gemini flights. After examining 10 of the more intriguing sightings, Roach could explain only 7 of them. He wrote that, the 3 unexplained sightings, which have been gleaned from a great mass of reports, are a challenge to the analyst. Especially puzzling is the first one of the list, the daytime sighting of an object showing details such as arms, antennas, protruding from a body having a noticeable angular extension. If the NORAD listing of objects near the GT-4 spacecraft at the time of the sighting is complete as it presumably is, we shall have to find a rational explanation or, alternatively, keep it on our list of unidentifieds. Physicist Gordon Thayer wrote the chapter Optical and Radar Sightings and concluded that one case, which occurred in Laken Heath, England in August 1965, was the most puzzling and unusual case in the radar visual files. The apparently rational, intelligent behavior of the UFO suggests a mechanical device of unknown origin as the most probable explanation of this sighting. One of the photographic cases examined by astronomer and photo analyst, Dr. William K. Hartman, involved 2 photographs taken by a farmer in McMinnville, Oregon in 1950. Hartman and his staff not only analyzed the original negatives but found and interviewed the farmer. Hartman concluded, "This is one of the few UFO reports in which all factors investigated appear to be consistent with the assertion that an extraordinary flying object, silvery, metallic, disc-shaped, tens of meters in diameter, and evidently artificial, flew within sight of 2 witnesses. It cannot be said that the evidence positively rules out a fabrication." He added, "Although there are some physical factors such as the accuracy of certain photometric measures of the original negatives which argue against a fabrication." Hartman noted that about 2% of cases involving photographic evidence appear to represent well-recorded but unidentified or unidentifiable objects that are airborne, i.e., UFOs. This, wrote Hartman, is not inconsistent with the hypothesis that unknown and extraordinary aircraft have penetrated the airspace of the United States. Many of the case reports contained conclusions like this: if the report is accurate, it was made by 6 Air Force officers and confirmed by ground and airborne radar. It describes an unusual, intriguing, and puzzling phenomenon which, in the absence of additional information, must be listed as unidentified. And this, taking into consideration the high credibility of information and the cohesiveness and continuity of accounts, combined with a high degree of strangeness, it is also certainly one of the most disturbing UFO incidents known today. Or, in conclusion, although conventional or natural explanations certainly cannot be ruled out, the probability of such seems low in this case, and the probability that at least one genuine UFO was involved appears to be fairly high. Kunden, who investigated few if any of the cases and talked rarely with his staff about their research, wrote the conclusion for the report. "No direct evidence whatever of a convincing nature now exists for the claim that any UFOs represent spacecraft visiting Earth from another civilization," he claimed. "Furthermore, nothing has come from the study of UFOs in the last 20 years that has added to scientific knowledge. And finally, careful consideration of the record, as it is available to us, leads us to conclude that further extensive study of UFOs probably cannot be justified in the expectation that science will be advanced thereby." In the Omni interview 18 years later, Hynek said, "It almost seemed to me as if Dr. Kunden had not read his own report. The report itself presented real mysteries." An 11-member panel from the National Academy of Sciences reviewed the Kunden report and approved its conclusions. "On the basis of present knowledge," noted the panel, "the least likely explanation of UFOs is the hypothesis of extraterrestrial visitations by intelligent beings." They agreed with Kunden, UFOs did not warrant further scientific study. In a press conference, January 11, 1969, Kehoe complained that the committee had examined only 50 cases from 1947 to 1967, and those were hardly typical of the reliable, unexplained reports. NICAP had 10 to 15,000 such cases in its files. Hynek wrote in his review that he would never have wasted his time on nearly two-thirds of the cases studied by the committee. The Air Force consultant also noted that members of the committee sometimes stretched so far to explain a sighting they came up with solutions like this: this unusual sighting should therefore be assigned to the category of some almost certainly natural phenomenon which is so rare that it apparently has never been reported before or since. Dr. Peter Sturrock, professor of astrophysics and space science at Stanford, wrote a lengthy evaluation of the Condon report for the Institute of Plasma Research. Sturrock concluded, "It is my opinion that the substance of the Condon report presents a persuasive case for the view that there is some phenomenological fire hidden behind the smoke of UFO reports and that the report, therefore, supports the proposition that further scientific study of UFOs is in order." On May 16, 1969, Roach, who had been responsible for the section on astronaut sightings, wrote to Hynek that he had attended a recent Condon lecture entitled UFOs I Have Loved and Lost. He was amusing, hilarious at times, but did not touch on the serious part of the investigation, said Roach. The listeners must have gone away with the erroneous impression that his encounters with psychopaths or retards represented the essence of the investigation rather than a peripheral aspect of the matter. Roach referred to all the errors and comedies of the investigation, and ended with, "The fallibility of scientists has been revealed, which is important, and the public may now enter a new era of confusion." 2 years after the Condon report, in November of 1970, a subcommittee on UFOs sponsored by the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics found that many of Condon's conclusions were his own, not based on research in the report. Nor was there a basis in the report for his prediction that nothing of scientific value will come of further studies. The subcommittee recommended increased study, finding it difficult to ignore the small residue of well-documented but unexplainable cases which form the hard core of the UFO controversy. Nevertheless, Hynek recalled, when the Condon report came out in 1968, it was the kiss of death. The Condon report recommended that the Air Force's efforts at Project Blue Book be discontinued. 1 year later, December 17, 1969, the Secretary of the Air Force announced that the Air Force's 22-year study of UFOs would be terminated. The Air Force got out of the UFO business, folded Project Blue Book, and declassified all files, 42 cubic feet of paper, over 80,000 pages. In 22 years, the Air Force had investigated 12,618 reported sightings, only 701 of which remained unsolved. The rest, the Air Force attributed to balloons, satellites, aircraft, lighting, reflections, stars, planets, the sun, the moon, weather conditions, or outright fabrications. Using the figures provided by the Air Force, once every 11 days for 22 years, someone in the United States sighted a flying object that no one could explain. But many people in the field had felt for some time that the Air Force and its Project Blue Book served only as a publicity front, that in fact, the real investigation had been conducted by another agency or agencies. Bill Spaulding of Ground Saucer Watch examined the newly declassified Air Force files in the early 70s and came away feeling something was missing. "It's always been our contention," said Spaulding, "that there was another agency or entity involved. In other words, the Air Force is not the bad guy. If you look at it logically, you'll see that the Air Force projects consisted of about five people, including some secretaries, very minuscule, who did nothing. The Air Force went around and gathered information. But after reviewing all the Project Blue Book files, we came across none of the cases that people had given to us. Where were they? What we found out was that another agency was involved, so we said, to heck with this. Let's go after the CIA." In 1975, Under the newly revised Freedom of Information Act, Ground Saucer Watch filed a request with the CIA for one copy of the 1953 Robertson Panel report. Responding to the request, the CIA declassified the controversial report but stated that the CIA's only involvement with UFOs was the Robertson Panel. At no time prior to the formation of the Robertson Panel and subsequent to the issuance of the panel's report, read the reply, has the CIA engaged in the study of the UFO phenomenon. The Robertson Panel report is a summation of the agency's interest and involvement in this matter. 3.5 years later, after extended litigation, the CIA was forced to admit to Ground Saucer Watch that it not only investigated the phenomenon before and long after the convening of the Robertson Panel but that it possessed 412 UFO-related documents that had originated within the CIA and another 199 documents that had originated with other government agencies. The CIA relinquished 900 pages of UFO sightings and internal policy on UFOs. While the litigation between GSW and the CIA progressed through the legal system, an independent UFO researcher filed another Freedom of Information request, this one with the super-secret National Security Agency. He received this reply, "Regarding your inquiry about UFOs, please be advised that NSA does not have any interest in UFOs in any manner," emphasis in original. But during its suit against the CIA, GSW learned that some of the CIA documents they sought had originated with NSA. After a new and again protracted legal battle, NSA released only two of its admitted 239 documents relating to UFOs, a decision upheld by the courts for reasons of national security. During the late 1970s and early 1980s, UFO groups and independent researchers, utilizing the Freedom of Information Act, prompted the release of 3,000 pages of previously classified material concerning UFOs reports, correspondence, minutes, and memoranda, all pieces of a historical puzzle that, when put together, revealed over 30 years of interest in UFOs by the State Department, Army, Navy, Air Force, FBI, CIA, NSA, and Defense Intelligence Agency. Among the thousands of pages of UFO-related documents, researchers found many old and revealing memoranda such as this one concealed in CIA files since 1950. On November 21 of that year, an engineer named Wilbert B. Smith in the Canadian Department of Transport wrote a proposal for a study of the Earth's magnetic field as a possible energy source. In the secret memo, he stated, "I made discreet inquiries through the Canadian embassy staff in Washington who were able to obtain for me the following information: A. The matter is the most highly classified subject in the United States government, rating higher even than the H-bomb. B. Flying saucers exist. C. Their modus operandi is unknown but concentrated effort is being made by a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush. D. The entire matter is considered by the United States authorities to be of tremendous significance. G. Since no one had ever uncovered a photo lab or darkroom where Edward Meyer might have developed and possibly fabricated his photographs, Elders and Welch wanted to know who processed his film. Perhaps that person could offer clues or even answers, making the testing of the photographs unnecessary. They discovered that Mia had all of his film developed at a small photography and video shop in Wetzikon called Bar Photo, part of a downtown shopping strip about 30 or 40 minutes from the farm. Bar Photo was owned by a couple in their mid-30s, Beatrice and Willie Bar, each of whom during the interview appeared to be bright and well-traveled, far more cosmopolitan than most of the people they had met at the farm. Each spoke English well. When Mia had first brought in rolls of black and white film to be developed, Barr himself had done much of the processing. "I never saw anything suspicious in the black and white film I developed," said Barr, "nor was I ever told to manipulate anything. A lot of people have suspected I did that, but no. When someone brings you pictures like this, your first reaction automatically is, this is a lot of crap. But he aroused my curiosity." Mia had even invited Ba several times to accompany him on a contact to photograph the beamships if he desired, but Ba had declined.